Just a few more comments about the churches that Eliana is very much into, the African-American churches in a place like Chester or like Philadelphia. That for most of these African-American churches that are mainline churches, you know, that are denominationally oriented, coming to church is the big cultural thing of the day or the week. And so people who are housemaids and people who have quite menial jobs, for church, this is the time when you dress up, when you come looking your very best. There's a tradition here. Chances are the women will wear hats. I mean, hats are a thing from another time, another era, another place. But in the African-American church, the older women will come wearing hats, and they will be dressed to the nines. What will happen every so often is this. A work group will come to Philadelphia to do something as a mission project. And they've heard me speak somewhere, and they understand about Mount Carmel Baptist Church being this wonderful place where there's exciting preaching and all kinds of fun and what have you, great music. And so on Sunday morning, this group will come to the church. Well, a group came to the church, and of course, they dress like kids from middle class, upper middle class kids come to church, looking terrible. Looking kind of like you, you know, messed up shirt, jacket, you know, kind of like Stephanie, sweatshirt, you know, I mean, and they come to the door. Yeah, Joshua, you know, we're talking very middle class. And all I'm saying is that they showed up and the deacon met them at the door and said, you can't come in here like that. The kids went ballistic and said, what do you mean we can't come in here like this? What kind of church is this that they won't let poor people into this place? He said, oh, we let poor people in. You're not poor. If you were poor and that they were the best clothes you had, you'd be welcome here. But they are not the best clothes that you have. When you come here, you put on the very best that you have. And the kids just couldn't handle this. And they said, well, if you were going to the White House, would you dress like that? Or would you put on a suit and a shirt and a tie? Wouldn't you dress up to go to see the President of the United States? Well, you're not going to see the President of the United States. You're coming here. You're coming in to meet the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords, the Creator of the universe, and you're going to come in like this? I'm sorry, you're not allowed in here. I had to write letters of explaining this to the church because the people were very irate. They wrote nasty letters to me saying, what kind of church do you have? They wouldn't let us in because we were... This is an affront. Is it that way in the church that you were part of? I mean, this is an affront. You come properly dressed. You walk in with dignity. And you see these guys who, if you met them on the street, would have their pants hanging down below their waist, you know, look like hoods. When they are on Sunday morning, they have a blue suit and a white shirt and a tie. And the boys and girls look like they're straight off of Wall Street. They're little miniature adults. And they walk with great dignity and great stature. Church becomes a place where you assert your dignity all at once. That's not true of the storefront church, but it is true of these regular established churches that you have. And I was explaining to them what we all know about Mount Carmel, that in the history of this church, it's an old standing church. They've only had two pastors. You come, you stay forever until the day you die. I mean, that's just the way it is. It has a completely different ethos because of that. And so we need to say that. We also need to say things about other ethnic groups that move into the city. For instance, there is the Native Americans who for years were migrating to the city. All of that has ended. A city like Minneapolis had a very intense Native American population at one time. As a matter of fact, those who identified themselves as Native Americans in the American population were down to about 400,000 to 500,000. All of a sudden, it's up to 1.6 million. Overnight, the number of Native Americans has increased from like 400,000 to 500,000 to 1.9 million. And what's more is they're leaving the city in large numbers. Can you guess what happened? Use your imagination. What do you think happened? Well, let me give you the simple thing. That first of all, the Bureau of Indian Affairs began making grants to people who were Native Americans. All of a sudden, a lot of people who hitherto didn't want to be identified as Native Americans began to say, I'm Native American. Number two is, and this is one you should have guessed, casinos developed on the reservations. They found out that the reservations, in a legal sense, were independent nations. I don't know whether you realize that. Reservations are independent nations. They exist by treaty agreement, which goes back to George Washington's day. This land is an independent nation, and consequently, the laws of the United States generally do not apply on the reservation, which means you can be in a state like Minnesota where gambling is prohibited, but you've got a reservation, and on the Indian reservation, which is an independent nation, the Indian Council decides what goes on and what doesn't go on. And they decide to put up a casino. And they put up these casinos, and all of a sudden, all over across the United States, you have Native Americans making a fortune in the casino business. And you're saying, isn't this terrible? They're ripping off people. People are losing their money. Poor people are going there and gambling away all that they have. And you almost say, this is horrible. And yet there seems to be a sense of justice in all of this. I mean, the Caucasian invaders. We sold booze to them. We made them into alcoholics. We exploited them. We stole from them. We ripped them off. And there's almost something just in saying, we got a reversal here. And all of a sudden, white people are going into the reservations and doing their gambling. But of course, what this has done is hastened a tremendous exodus of Native American people from the cities to the reservation. Do you see how this process, and this is something that's happened only in the last 10 years. Like I said, the demography of cities has changed dramatically in the last 10 years, and that's just one little evidence. I talked about the effect of the computer in changing the structure of cities, but more important than anything else is the changing of industry. It used to be that industrial work was located in the city. As a matter of fact, if you go through Burgess's concentric circle theory. You know, you come to Center City, and then the next ring out was you had factories. The factories aren't in the second ring anymore. They're way out in the suburbs. What's even more than that, they've actually moved many of the factories out into rural areas. Every new automobile factory that has been built over the last 15 years has been built in a rural location. I don't know, there was a Volkswagen factory built not too far from Pittsburgh. New Stanton. Yeah, there's a real urban center. You knew Stanton, Pennsylvania. And I mean, they're building these automobile factories, and they're usually Japanese factories, which is kind of ironical because people say, I'm going to buy American. I'm not going to buy one of those Japanese cars. The truth is that the Japanese cars are produced in the United States. If you buy a Chevrolet, on the other hand, chances are it was produced either in Mexico or Canada. That's the reality. The American cars aren't produced in America, and the Japanese cars are, and the Japanese builders are building these factories out in rural areas, do you see, which make them very inaccessible to certain people who are in quote-unquote native other ethnic groups. African Americans can't get to them. Hispanic people can't get to them. Do you see? They're out there in the middle of nowhere. It's frightening to see this whole transition take place and factories moving out. And the net result is that at rush hour, it isn't like it used to be. When I was a student here and they just opened up the Schuylkill Expressway, you knew what the problem was. In the morning, traffic was very heavy going into the city. In the evening, what? Very heavy coming out of the city. People commuted into the city to work and commuted out. Now what has happened is that the factories are located out in the suburbs. Philadelphia Gear Works is located in King of Prussia. These industrial parks are built out in the suburbs. If you were to go over here where the offices of the American Baptist Churches is located in Valley Forge, it's an industrial park out in King of Prussia. Where do these people live? Very often they live in the city and come out on the Schuylkill Expressway. In short, there are more people commuting from the city to the suburbs to work than commuting from the suburbs into the city to work. A complete reversal. This has all been something that's happened in the last 25 years. And of course, with this process has come the yuppieization of the city. You have young singles moving into the city, causing tremendous rejuvenation. The other night when Peggy and I went to the Academy of Music, I got off the Schuylkill Expressway to go to the Academy of Music on South Street. She never said a word. 5 or even 10 years ago, if I had gotten off of South Street and driven up South Street, my wife, who gets frightened very easily, saying, how are we going to get out of this neighborhood? Because it was a rundown slum. What has happened is yuppies have bought up all these houses, and they are all upgraded, and they are all very lovely, and there it is. You have this whole single population moving into the city. So who lives in the city now? You've got a lot of single people, and of course, there are sections of the city. Up around 10th and Vine, you have a huge gay community. A huge gay community. They live in the neighborhood. They don't get hassled in that neighborhood. They don't have any trouble going to the restaurants. They don't get any difficulty. And they're with people with whom they feel a deep sense of acceptance. So we have a new natural area that, in fact, Robert Park never imagined, namely a gay community emerging in the community. So these are very fascinating transitions that have taken place in the city. Now, we talked about religion. We talked about changing economic structures. I want to talk about a couple of other changing structures. First of all, I mentioned earlier in response to this question that was raised, something about how family life has changed and how family life is disintegrating in America, primarily because families are dysfunctional in an urban industrial setting. Children on a farm are necessary. In an urban industrial setting, they are an economic liability. I pointed this out. The net result is we have fewer and fewer children. I made that point. The family gets smaller and smaller and smaller. But please note, there's a big difference between the way children are raised in small families as opposed to how they are raised in large families. I mean, Sig, you only had one child, right? Why did you even want a child? That's a good question. Is this child going to contribute economically to the well-being of your family? How much money did this child earn for you? How much profit did you get because of this child? None. He was an economic disaster for you, an economic liability. So why do you have the child? You have the child for emotional gratification. At least that's what they're supposed to deliver. Most children deliver aggravation. And you begin to say, why have children? So not only do you have single people in the city, but when they do get married, guess what? They're not interested in having children. You meet them increasingly. Bright university graduates not having children. And they're living in the city because it interferes with the whole urban way of life that they have come to accept. I mean, you can't go into the theater when you want to go. You can't do this. You can't do that. I mean, they're just a pain in the neck. And so you have fewer and fewer children, and the family becomes very, very small. Now, like I said, there's a difference between children raised in a small family and children raised in a large family. Here's the big difference. Are you ready for it? In a large family, children are socialized to adapt to the expectations of a larger group. You have 10 children, 9 children, 8 children. The child learns to fit in with the expectations of a group. You go to dinner. If you got one child, 2 children, you ask, honey, what time would you like dinner? Well, I'm going to be a little late. I got basketball practice. Okay. What time do you think you'll be home? 6:30? Fine. We'll have dinner ready for you then. You do that with one child, 2 children. If you have 10 kids, you do not say, honey, what time would you like dinner? If you have 10 kids, you say what? Charlie, dinner will be at 5:30. If you're here, you eat. Kid catches on. He better be there at 5:30. And if he doesn't show up at 5:30, there may be some degree of rejoicing if he doesn't show up at 5:30, right? In a small family, you want to prepare food that the child really likes. Large family, who cares? You put it on the table, and if the kid says, I don't like it, the kid next to him says, good, chum, boom, it's gone. I went to do research on large families in North Dakota, where they still have large families in North Dakota, for a simple reason. What else is there to do in North Dakota? And so they come to dinner. The first night, I'm at this family with 10 children, mother and father. That's 12. I make 13. See, now at your house, Sig, you had one child and you had two bathrooms, and he could, didn't you? Yes, and you probably had a washroom down in the basement if you needed it. I mean, and the kid could take his time. In this house, everybody had his 3 minutes. Every movement was timed, and you can take that any way you want to take it. But you went in there, and you did your movement, and you were out of there. And if you didn't cut out when you were supposed to, people would be banging on the door and saying, you're holding everybody, you're holding up everybody, right? Can you get the picture? One bathroom, it was scheduled. And then you come down for dinner that night, and we all sit around the table. And the father says, it's time to pray. I thought this was touching. I'm a godly man. I love having people pray before dinner, especially holding hands in a fellowship circle as we pray before dinner. You know why we were holding hands when we were praying? So that nobody would steal any of the food while our eyes were closed. Exactly. You're beginning to get the message here. It's a completely different setting. You know, kids eat what is on the table. That in fact, you fit in with the system. In the morning, you fit in with the system. Everybody in the morning has, in a large family, everybody has a responsibility, a job to do. Everybody has a family assignment. Very often in a large family, there will actually be a chart on the wall where people have to check off what they're, did they do this, did they do that? I was the last remnant of a large family. I'm Italian, and our family was small. Two sisters and myself, that's three of us, but even there, we had our chores. I made the beds till this day. I don't do much else around the house, but I do make the bed in the morning. It's what I was raised on. It was one of my jobs to make all the beds in the morning because the girls got up first. They got out of the house, and I was the last one out of the house. I made all the beds. I mean, I'm 10 years old. I made all the beds. Secondly, it was my responsibility on Saturday to clean the basement. Rose had the first floor, and Ann had the second floor. We had our jobs. Large family, everything is spelled out. Chores are specified. You run a large family like you run a company. It has to be organized, or else it would be chaotic. It's totally structured. Small family, there's no structure whatsoever. The kids go to the bathroom when they feel like it. They come out of the bathroom when they feel like it. They leave their room a mess. I mean, it's a small family. Who cares? You just kind of live your own life. And the child goes off to school. Now note, it used to be that children were raised in large families, and then they went to school. When I went to school, elementary school, the typical size of a classroom in West Philadelphia at the Bryan School were 42 children per classroom. Did you hear that? That was the normal size. Exactly, 42 children. No problem. No problem. Because people were used to operating in the context of a larger group and used to having chores. We're running Cornerstone Christian Academy. The kids have no chores. When I went to school, at the end of the day, who was going to clean the boards? Who was going to sweep the floor? And you vie for the privilege. I get to do the boards today. Jeez, they leave the school a mess today. And they come in, and now we want small classrooms with individualized attention. So this child grows up in this small family where he's catered to as an individual. He then goes now in the urban setting to this school. And I want to do my imitation of the principal at a PTA meeting. Here at the Roland School, we try to tailor the education to meet the needs of the individual pupil. We think that each child here at Roland is special, unique, a little flower that blooms in his own way, in his own time, and in his own manner. And we would do nothing to stifle that child's individuality or creativity. The problem is, the kid grows up in the small family where he's catered to as an individual. He goes to this school where he's catered to as an individual, but sooner or later he has to go and work for General Motors. And guess what? At the General Motors factory, the management does not say, here at GM, We try to tailor the job to meet the needs of the individual worker. We think that each employee here at GM is special, unique, a little flower that blossoms in his own way in his own time. And we would do nothing to stifle the child's individuality or creativity. No way. No way. At General Motors, he's got to conform to this massive system. But here's the problem. He's never conformed to a system in his whole life. How is he going to handle this? He handles it in a very simple way. He puts off going to work at General Motors as long as possible. He takes a few years off to travel. He does everything to stay out of the system. Why would... You won't understand young people like you and like you, Anna, which you don't have your name here, and Devin. We don't understand people like... See, people like you, I don't want to break it to you. You don't want to become adults. I mean, yes, I know. Stephanie's not going to argue with... And I know why. You look at adults and says, who wants to become an adult? We see father come home, nervous, tense, tight. Here's this kid who's been spontaneously floating around. Why in the world would he or she ever want to become an adult? I mean, adulthood is fitting into a system, and this child has never fit into a system in his whole life. He doesn't want to fit into one now. Can't you understand why he comes into the office and says, I'm going to take a little time off. Gosh. I'm just not ready for this. And incidentally, one of the great ways to take time off is to go to college. And once again, sociologists have to ask the question, what is the functionality of college? And I know what they told you. Go to college and get a good education, because if you get a good education, you'll get a good job. You heard that line, didn't you? The studies now indicate that if you go into the workforce immediately out of high school, within 10 years, you will probably be earning more money than if you went to college. Because nobody cares about your education anymore. You graduate from college. This is like 70% of the population now goes to college. You graduate and you're going to end up working in the department store in the sales department. And guess what? The kid who went to work in the sales department right out of high school is now your boss, because he's been there for 10 years and he's got seniority. And you come out of college and you're in real trouble, because he's going to look at you and say, so you think you're smart, huh? Just because you went to college. Be ready for humiliation. Be ready for degradation. Are you ready for this, Thomas? Because that's what you're going to face. And the studies indicate everything's changed in the last 15 to 20 years. The kid that comes right out of high school, he goes to work as a plumber. He's going to be making more money than you're making when he's 25. Goes to work as an electrician. He's going to make twice as much money as you're making by the time he's 25. I mean, he's ahead of you. Do you understand? Education is no big deal to economic success. It helps make you cultured, which is the whole problem. When you people come to college, you take the wrong disciplines. You don't study stuff like sociology. You don't study stuff like art and music and literature and poetry. Instead, I ask people, I'm studying business. What are you learning? Computer programming. Let me break it to you. Everything that you learn in that computer course is going to be totally out of date within 5 years after you graduate. Going to argue with me on this one? That in fact, the only way you're going to be able to keep up is by constantly learning about the computer, because they're always coming out with just when you think you got the system down pat, Bill Gates announces, I have a new Windows program. And you got to learn all over again. Are they constantly coming out with new technology that makes everything that existed a few years earlier out of date, totally dysfunctional? I hate to break it, but Alan Bloom wrote this book about a higher education. And he basically talked about the fact that liberal arts has come to an end. And what we really ought to do is reintroduce liberal arts, because liberal arts is the only thing that prepares you for life, not the courses that you're taking. Almost every student I meet in a university these days is taking business or program or computer program. It's a waste. My daughter went to Williams College. They don't have a single business course there. Harvard does not have a business course on the undergraduate level. You know that? You can't go to Harvard and major in business. It's that way at Amherst. It's that way at Bates. It's that way at all these elitist schools. You can't take a business course at Swarthmore. They're into liberal arts. And you know what? When it comes time for graduation, if you walked across Williams campus, if you walked across the campus at Amherst, you'd be tripping over recruiters because they come from the big companies to recruit at these schools for the business establishment. And you say, why there? These people don't know anything about business. Everything that you need about business, we can teach you. What we want is somebody who knows how to go out to dinner with a client and doesn't have egg on his tie and knows how to speak English without making grammatical errors, who doesn't sound like, I'm ashamed to say it, George Bush. I want somebody who can speak the language, who can write the language. Most people cannot read or write. I mean, stop to think. Have you picked up any instructions for a new piece of machinery or something? And you read it and say, who wrote this thing? There are grammatical mistakes, number one, and number two, I don't even know what they're talking about. They don't know how to express themselves with clarity. Don't you find this with most of the instruction sheets you meet? And these big businesses say, we want somebody that knows how to write poetically, who in fact, if he becomes executive vice president, will not embarrass the company when he's out there dealing with people. We want polish, we want panache. And you don't get that with kids who took a course in accounting and business administration. And you say, you're putting down? Of course I'm putting down this school. What Bloom was saying is we have taken university education and turned it into a vocational school. We want to provide, they don't know any history. I love this. Every once in a while, they'll do this. Jay Leno, do you ever see these things? He'll go to a college campus and ask very, very easy to answer questions about politics or history. And these kids who are, you know, what year are you in college? I'm a junior. Tell me, in World War II, who were we fighting against? The Russians? No, it wasn't the Russians. I mean, they're this stupid. And you're saying these kids are idiots. Of course they're idiots. They don't know anything. You come out of college, you are uneducated. All you have are some technical skills. Education is a bust. You say, well, why do they even maintain the system? For a very simple reason. This is why we maintain the system. What would happen to the unemployment level of this country if young people who didn't need a college education didn't go to college? Think of the millions of people that are taken out of the workforce. In short, universities and colleges exist in America, this is what a sociologist would tell you, to keep the unemployment level down. This is what is called systems analysis. You say, what is the function of an education? You say, to prepare people for jobs. I guarantee you, I don't care what you're majoring in, there's a strong probability you won't end up with a job that has anything to do with your major. Point being, then why do they want me to go to college? To keep you out of the workforce, people. If we let you loose, if we closed down the colleges and said, go out and get a job. Peggy and I were in New Zealand the other week. Hardly anybody goes to college in New Zealand. And we were kind of appalled over the low level of knowledge and sophistication in New Zealand. But people are working, and they've got jobs, and the country works perfectly without a bunch of college grads. You see, you begin to ask questions about education. Small schools and provide people for this mass society, but kids don't know how to fit into the mass society, so they put off taking their place in the mass society as long as possible. And one of the means for doing this is, in fact, going to college. And beyond that, if you really want to stay out of the market, you could go to grad school. And you could even go for a PhD. And maybe by the time you're 32 or 33, you can leave and go out into the real world. This is scary stuff. Is it not true? Do you not observe this phenomenon as you look at the American society and ask, what is the point of education? And what do education systems really do? They keep people out of the workforce. And that's why the government is more than willing to pour millions, yea, billions of dollars into higher education, because this is what it does for the society. It's very functional. It's very functional. Colleges and universities are very functional in that they keep people like you out of the labor market for a few years and hence sustain the system even more efficiently. Now let's get to education itself, which is another institution that needs to be looked at in an urban setting. A study was done in Baltimore, Maryland. Are you ready for this? they found that the typical child in the Baltimore school system watched television 6.5 hours a day. What does this do to education? What's even more is that television has become very, very problematic. They discovered something about television. Here it is. They discovered that they would put these programs on, and when it came time for the commercials, you know what people would do? They would get up, go to the refrigerator, get a sandwich, get a beer, and come back when the commercials were over. They weren't watching the commercials. And the people that were running the commercials are saying, what's going on here? We're paying all this money to sponsor the show, and nobody's watching the commercials. And what's the point? We're losing money. So what we had to do in America is something absolutely incredible. We had to make the commercials more interesting than the shows. Did we succeed? We certainly did succeed. Commercials are absolutely fascinating, and they're interesting, and they are marked by one thing that the people in television learn very quickly. Leander, L-E-A-N-D-E-E-R, Leander, wrote a book called 4 Reasons for the Elimination of Television. And one of the reasons was that television holds people's attention through technical changes. You say, what do you mean, technical changes? The minute you turn on PBS, you don't even have to be told it's a PBS station. The minute you turn it on, you know it's PBS, even if it's a drama. And the reason is, even if it's a drama or a musical, the level of technical change is very low because they don't have enough money to do that high level of technical changes. Take an ad. Let's take a Visa ad that I once had my students see. When I was doing a regular teaching thing, I would say, here's your assignment. You're to study 10 commercials on television, and you are to count the number of technical changes per minute. There was a Visa ad with 122 technical changes a minute. You say, what's a technical change? When they change the image, they change the angle. One image, then another image, then another image, then another image, so that you are literally mesmerized by the number of images that are thrown at you. You don't see anything for more than a split second. Have you seen these ads and you wish they would just stay a moment longer? Boom, 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 right down the line. One image after another image after another image. And they found that they could mesmerize people by having a higher level of technical changes during the ads as opposed to the technical changes during the show. And so all of a sudden the ads became more interesting than the show, not only because they were more humorous, but because there were more technical changes, like this course is. You got basically two cameras. Usually when they do, 3 cameras. Usually when they do one of these things, they have 1 camera. And it's boring as all get out. The fact that we got 3 cameras doing this is going to make this particular presentation much more interesting than any other video show you have ever seen before. You see that guy over there? He's moving the camera. Even as we speak, he's moving the camera. He's creating what? A technical change. Please understand, the movies, the theater, are all built on holding attention through technical changes. Now, here's the problem. This kid is raised on this stuff. What's more is, the worst show on television, so far as sociologists who have their sense about them realize, is Sesame Street. I know that's going to blow your mind. Sesame Street? What's wrong with Sesame Street? I love Sesame Street. Of course you love Sesame Street. It's absolutely fascinating because Sesame Street is what? Filled with technical changes. They never allow Sesame Street to be used in the Soviet Union, because they didn't want their kids destroyed. You see, Sesame Street ruins kids. Oh, wait a minute, I see you looking skeptical. Watch Sesame Street. Do they teach you the alphabet on Sesame Street? You bet they do. They say A, and A becomes an app ball. It becomes an airplane. It becomes something else with an A.
An astronaut.
An astronaut, yeah. And they will show, will they show you an astronaut, an apple, and it goes, boom, 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 A, 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 A. You get A thrown at you 20 times in a row with 20 different images. Got the picture? The kid now goes to school in the first grade, and he sits down, and the teacher says, boys and girls, we're going to learn the alphabet today. The first letter of the alphabet is A. And she takes a piece of chalk and she goes to the board and she draws A. And the kid sits there waiting for something to happen. Isn't A going to dance? Isn't it going to sing? Isn't there going to be a music background? Isn't it going to turn into an airplane? Isn't it going to turn into an apple? It just sits there on the board. Namely, the whole world becomes boring once you've watched television. Peggy remembers when I took Bart and Lisa. That's tough, having two children named Bart and Lisa when you look like Homer. It's tough. But I took Bart and Lisa with me, guess where? On a trip across the United States, and we stood at the edge of the Grand Canyon. And I said, isn't this incredible? And my kids looked up the Grand Canyon and down the Grand Canyon. And they said, can we go now? They wanted to go back to the motel and watch TV. And I said, I want you to look at the Grand Canyon. And I can still hear Lisa saying, I saw it. I said, look again. But you do have to understand something. They had already seen the Grand Canyon on television. They had seen it in an ad where an airplane carried them down into the canyon and up through the canyon and around the curves of the canyon into the rushing waters of the canyon. And they did it all in 20 seconds. And the Grand Canyon was much more exciting on television than it is in real life. Reality becomes boring. One of my friends who was a minister in Westchester, Philip Lister, was telling me when he was pastor of that church that during midweek prayer meeting, when they were asking for prayer requests, a woman in the church said that there was a woman that she knew that was in deep need of prayer because she was going through a very difficult time in her family life. And Phil wanted to know, who is it? It turned out to be a character on the soap opera. And he said, well, she's not real. And the woman said, well, it doesn't mean that she isn't going through a hard time. I mean, you know, you feel like saying, I can't believe this. But the characters there was a movie that made all of this very famous and brought it all to the surface. Every once in a while, they show it on television. You can get it at Blockbusters. It's called Network. Have you ever seen that movie, Network? And you remember this guy who's going to be put off the air. He's an old newscaster, and they want somebody young and sexy looking. And this old guy is going to lose his job. But he starts yelling on this television, go to the window, throw up the window, and yell at the top of your lungs, I'm mad as hell, and I'm not going to put up with it anymore. And of course, people are doing it all over. You remember the scene, they're doing it all over. And the point he makes is that his ratings soar for one reason. He announces one week that he is going to, they're putting him off the show at the end of next week. And he wanted the audience to know that next week at the end of the show, he is going to blow his brains out on camera. You know what happened to the ratings. They soared and went up and up and up. And by this time, the guy's becoming insane. And the more insane he becomes, the more interesting he becomes. And there's a scene where he yells at the audience, turn off this show. I'm not real. None of this is real. This background isn't real. Turn off the show. Talk to your wife. Talk to your husband. Play with your kids. This isn't real. Do you understand? And he's screaming at the audience like I'm screaming at you. This is reality. Television has, in fact, created a mindset. And that mindset is that we don't pay attention to anything unless it has rapid technical changes, which is what makes this course so uninteresting. I'm just standing up here talking. There are no technical changes. And what the guys who are filming this thing would have liked from you students is more questions, more arguments, because it would have created more technical changes. They could have shoved the camera around a little more, get another angle, get another face instead of this stupid Campolo face. Hour after hour after hour, that's all we see. Campolo, this is boring. I want to see Anna. I want to see Josh. I want to see David. Let me see their faces. I want to see them arguing. I want to see them intense. Technical changes. What happens to a society like Baltimore where the typical kid, this is the medium. The medium is that most kids in Baltimore, not the average, most kids in Baltimore, sociologically, the difference between an average and a medium is very different. If you have one kid watching 1 hour of television, the other kid watching 12 hours of television, the average is 6 hours. But that doesn't tell you what's going on. Statistically, you've got to figure the medium. The median is what most people are doing, which requires you taking a course in statistics if you're going to be a sociologist, because you've got to figure the medium. And you find that the medium is that the medium for what most people are doing, most high school kids in Baltimore are watching television 6.5 hours a day. When they go to school, school is going to be one thing to them. It's going to be boring. School is absolutely boring. You say, what happened to the excitement for learning? Because learning is unexciting. It just doesn't have much in the way of technical changes. Do you begin to understand what the problems of education are in this? So you have to have smaller and smaller classes so that the students can be kept in deeper levels of engagement. You say, you know, I just don't know the kids are learning like they used to. Of course they're not. The schools have to fight up against television, which has molded a whole subculture of education that is different than anything we ever learned before. This is what we call urbanism. This is not urbanization. This is urbanism. Remember I said there's a difference between being living in a city and being caught up in an urban culture. Urbanism. This is an urbanism effect.